In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Another great double feature today on Word Balloon. We catch up with Jeff Lemire, who's been doing great work on Animal Man, Frankenstein Agent of Shade, and soon to be taking over Justice League Dark for DC Comics. We talk about Jeff's transition to the mainstream after having such a successful run of independent books like his classic Essex County for Top Shelf. Jeff also talks about a new project he has coming up for Top Shelf. It's all coming up on the first part of Word Balloon. Then we turn to Nunzio De Filippis and Christina Weir, the great writing team that has done wonderful work on television shows like Arliss. They've also been doing great young adult books with female heroines, and we're going to be talking about some of those today. Play Ball and the Avalon Chronicles, but also Oni Press has tapped them as the writers of their book that they are presenting for Free Comic Book Day, a new series called Bad Medicine. We'll be talking about that with Christina Annunzio and more on this edition of Word Balloon, all brought to you today by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. You know the drill. InStockTrades.com has great deals for you. More than 38% off the cover price of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more. Don't forget, orders of $50 or more, you'll get free shipping at InStockTrades.com. Also, the deal of the week, 50% off Avengers, The Children's Crusade, Jim Chung and Alan Heinberg, $17.49 for the hardcover of The Children's Crusade, a great Avengers story from InStockTrades.com. You can also find books like Northlanders Volume 6, Brian Woods' Thursday, a great book, 40% off, just $8.99. Showcases Young Love, the great romance comics of DC from the 60s and 70s, 40% off, just $11.99. You won't believe the art in those romance books, and it's waiting for you from InStockTrades.com. The best miniseries to come out of the Flashpoint event last year, and that is the Batman Flashpoint series. The 100 Bullets team, Brian Azzarello, Dave Johnson, Eduardo Risso, 40% off, just $10.79 at InStockTrades.com. Let's pick things up with our friend Jeff Lemire. Now, this was a Skype conversation. God only knows, I had a different computer that I had to use for this Skype conversation with Jeff, but it almost sounds like we're outside. You'll forgive me. You can hear Jeff fine. You can hear me fine. But there is some sort of surface noise there. It's not enough to make you tune out, I promise you. But again, if anything, it sounds like we're recording outside. But I know he was at his drafting desk. I was in my radio studio. But regardless, a wonderful conversation with what's going on in Jeff Lemire's mind. I hope you enjoy it on this portion of Word Balloon. What I saw in Superboy is being fulfilled in all your superhero titles. And you are an incredibly well-rounded writer, truly.
Oh, thanks. It kind of comes as a surprise to me as well. I was always someone who I just anticipated always writing and drawing my own stuff and doing indie stuff, you know. And to work at DC at all was a surprise, and then to see that I could actually pull it off, I think I surprised myself as much as them. But it's fun. It's pushing me in all these new directions, and you know, when I first started Superboy, you know, I had the small town setting and all that stuff, so there was a bit of a comfort zone there from Essex County and stuff, but now it's forcing me to kind of go in all these new directions and really grow as a writer and stuff, and it's been exciting, and I think that will start to feed back into my next, you know, create your own stuff, whenever that is, post Sweet Tooth, because I think I'll start going in some new directions there that maybe I wouldn't have if I hadn't been, you know, writing the DC stuff.
Well, all I can say is everything seems to be getting brighter with each book, because I mean, Superboy, you really did this good balance of showing a real dark side, despite having his Smallville comfort zone. But you look at books now, you've got a very Vertigo tasting Animal Man that's reminiscent of, you know, the classic runs from the 80s and 90s. But it's, you know, firmly ensconced in the DC universe, and I want to get into that. But first, Frankenstein is such a fun book, and it's really great having these kind of secret, you know, agent, you know, global adventures with this team of monsters, and they seem, despite their appearance, to be very normal people, and it's just a lot of fun. I really love the characterizations and the situations that you're putting them in.
Yeah, I mean, I really, really love writing that book. It's it was kind of a hard decision to, you know, the decision to leave for Justice League Dark was really tough, but I think the only thing that kind of made it possible for me was that I knew that Matt Kent would take it over, and in a lot of ways, he had always kind of been they're helping with me with that book, so that was nice. And I also have plans for the Frankenstein character elsewhere, so I knew I wouldn't be the last time I wrote him. But yeah, I mean, that book really, I think I said before, but Animal Man and Sweet Tooth are so dark and full of dread and stuff that I needed that balance. I needed that really big, fun superhero team book, you know, and just doing that with a group of monsters is really fun to do.
And I like how we're learning about not only their history, but in, you know, turn, the DC history. And that's the thing, it started with the fact in that Flashpoint miniseries that these were the guys that fought World War II. And obviously it's carried over, and you're getting this very subtle, you know, reworking of DC history, where instead of it being a Justice Society or a bunch of mystery men, it's these monsters that have been taking care of the world in the Gold and Silver Ages.
Yeah, it's really cool because, it's just like you said, normally it would be the Justice Society and stuff like that, but since superheroes in this new world have only been around for 5 years or whatever, you know, it ends up being Frankenstein, who's kind of like the secret superhero that kind of held things together for the last century. And you'll see in the Men of War, the last issue of Men of War, that they asked me and Matt to co-write the Frankenstein and World War II thing. You really start to see some more of that kind of secret history of the DC universe, and we see G.I. Robot appear, and then we, at the end of that issue, we get to kind of see some other things that Frank did after World War II. So that was really fun, kind of exploring that. I think Matt has plans to go even further with that in exploring stuff earlier, you know, early turn of the century stuff. So that's one of the real fun things about that world, the Frankenstein world.
When is that Men of War issue coming out?
I think it's next month. I think it's April. It's the 8th issue. So.
Okay.
And it's great because it was like 40 pages, or no, was it 28 pages? So it's like almost a double-sized, big, fun adventure book. It's kind of like the old school war comics from the 70s or whatever, where me and Matt sort of split it up into four chapters, and we each wrote a chapter, and we kind of alternated writing chapters and split the team up into different groups and going on adventures and stuff. So it's just a real nod to kind of the stuff we grew up reading.
That's great, man, and I'm glad to let everyone know that Metaphor 8 is something that, you know, followers of Frankenstein should definitely grab. And it sounds like it is kind of a bridge then between your run on it and then Matt's run too.
Yeah, for sure. And Matt's, I just got to read Matt's outline for his first three or four issues last week, and it's so fun. It was, any regrets I had in leaving were gone, because now I just can't wait to read his stories. They're really fun. He's really taking it in sort of the super spy direction. And I probably shouldn't tell you this, but I think the first issue he wrote, the title of the issue is Tinker Tailor Monster Spy.
So he takes over with 9 as well, and you take over Justice League Dark with 9?
Actually, you know, I stayed on. Matt takes over at 10. I stayed on and did one more issue of Frankenstein, because they asked me to do an Animal Man sort of crossover, and I couldn't turn that down. So we get to see my last issue, Frankenstein and Nina sort of investigate the trail of Animal Man from, you know, they kind of follow all the death and destruction he caused in the first 9 issues. Frank sort of is investigating that, and so we get a little crossover between those two books, which is a lot of fun.
Do you foresee Frankenstein then crossing further with what you and Scott are doing with Swamp Thing and Animal Man?
I'm not sure yet about that, and if I am sure, I can't say yes or no.
Fair enough, I understand.
One thing I do want to do with Justice League Dark is kind of make, you know, Constantine, Zatanna, Deadman, Black Orchid, they're sort of like the core group, and then other characters from the dark world like Frankenstein, Animal Man, Eye Vampire, Resurrection Man, these kind of characters are kind of like satellite members, you know, that they can call up for certain missions if they need them. So I think it probably won't be too long until Frankenstein pops up in Dark as well.
That's awesome. Let's quickly, because I don't know how much you can say about Justice League Dark. You're taking over with issue 9, and we've seen the preview. I'm glad you mentioned Black Orchid, because I'm so glad to see her back, and I think you're the right kind of creator that she should be in your hands. So what is it about Black Orchid to start things off that interested you in making her part of the team?
There's a couple things. I mean, the version of Black Orca that I'm using is a brand new character, so it's not the classic character or the Vertigo version. It's a new incarnation of the character. And I don't want to spoil too much because there's kind of a lot of mystery surrounding her as you start to read the book, and who she is, what her powers are, where she comes from, are all a big kind of mystery that will, you know, slowly be revealed as the story unfolds. But she, I mean, I just, for me, taking over Dark, the fun thing is kind of seeing all the classic Vertigo era characters kind of interacting with the DC universe again. And so when I got on the book, I basically asked for all of them. You know, I wanted Kid Eternity and Black Orchid and just anyone who had a Vertigo book that was a DC property. Some of them I got, some of them I didn't, but so Orchid was on that list for sure. And I think it's also nice to add another female to the book, and we'll also see that she's not a white character as well. And up in Pete's run, everyone was white, so I thought it would be good to have some diversity in the group and have more of a global sort of feel to the book.
Fantastic. And, you know, much like Frank, I mean, it sounds like this is going to be kind of a globetrotting team that's going to be dealing with a lot of different situations.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, I don't want to criticize Pete Milligan because I have a huge, huge amount of respect for him as a writer. He's one of my heroes and stuff. But for me, I felt like Pete's book was a bit too serious, maybe. I thought that, I know it's Justice League Dark and it's a lot of the darker occult characters and stuff, but I didn't think that necessarily meant that it couldn't still be sort of fun and put those. For me, the fun thing is taking these kind of weird, dark characters and then contrasting them with sort of this bigger, brighter DC universe. That's really what brings out their personality, right? So it really is going to be a really fun, you know, globetrotting superhero book, but with magical superheroes, kind of, you know? And then Constantine in the middle of this, which is like the last thing he ever wanted to be a part of, and he just despises being part of this world at all, which is really fun a fun starting point for him.
Well, you're right, and I think a conflict is where story comes from. So rather than put these people in their usual dark and dank and sad kind of backgrounds and stuff,
yeah,
absolutely make them uncomfortable, because you're right, that is where personality and character comes out. And yes, I mean, if you really want to piss off John Constantine, put him at a kid's birthday party and put a hat on him and stuff.
Yeah.
So that's fantastic. And no, I'm really excited for it, man, and I love the team that you've selected that we've seen so far, and very excited to see what directions they go in. You know, you've been, it, again, I think your books in particular, well, I should say that the superhero, but the lighter books have been this great tour of the DC universe through your eyes and your character's eyes, and that's I think that's great, and I know that your love of what's come before, you'll put a topspin on it and give us a new look at it in this reboot and everything. And that's fine. Black Orchid, perfect example of that. You know, take the best elements of her. But I think certainly there have been so many startups and shutdowns of the character. Why not have a new Black Orchid? That's fantastic.
Yeah, why not? And she's not going to be what people expect at all, I think. She's it's definitely a unique take on her, and I can't spill the beans. But, you know, a part of it, too, is what we're going back to is, like, the first question I had when they offered me the book was, why is Justice League in the title of that book, other than to boost sales? Like, what purpose?
Sure.
How and why are these group of characters, even if they never call themselves Justice League Dark within the actual book, why is it that on the title? So I had to, so, you know, I had to kind of think of a reason or a way to connect it to the Justice League franchise and in a more tangible way. And then, you know, this led to a lot of conversations with Jeff Johns, who's writing the flagship book. And then we just started getting really excited. And just much like when Scott and I started talking about Animal Man and Swamp Thing and all these ideas and story ideas and stuff started popping up just out of our conversations, that's kind of what's been happening now with Jeff. So the two of us are just both really excited about both writing Justice League books. And then I think we have a big story that's kind of percolating now that, you know, to really bring the Justice League franchise together, international Justice League and Dark, and do something really fun with all these characters. And so that's really exciting for me, too.
Is there a spoiler-free story, you know, non-story answer to your question that Jeff gave you that you can share with us?
I don't think so, because I will say that in my first issue, issue 9, I wrote it, I tried to write it as if it was a first issue, so it's completely accessible. Anyone who can read it, who hasn't been reading the series, and if you've never read or aren't familiar with these characters, you'll pretty quickly get to know who each of them are and what they can do and stuff. But in that first issue, very quickly I establish why Justice League is in the title and what their connection to Jeff and Jim Lee's Justice League is. And I think it might be surprising to some people, but I think I came up with a pretty good solution.
Fantastic, man. No, it's, I understand it. I think these other Justice League titles do need to find their voice and their reason for being, and based on even what you've been telling us so far, it sounds like you got a good handle on it. So good luck with Justice League Dark. I'm very much looking forward to issue 9 and seeing where you guys go with this book. So who's drawing it for you again?
It's the same artist that was doing Pete's run, Mikel Janin, and his staff. Okay. And he's really great, and he's been a lot of fun to work with. There's been a couple things that got spoiled in the previews that I wasn't really – I kind of wanted to save for surprises. But one really fun thing that we find out pretty quickly is that they get a new headquarters, and it's the House of Mystery, which is going to be a lot of fun to play with. And then, Black Orchid's in the team, and Shade leaves the team. I just felt Shade is such a character that's – he's so strongly associated with Pete Milligan, and in a way is kind of – Pete's character in a lot of ways, so I didn't feel comfortable writing him. So Shade's gone, Black Orchid joins, one of the old Global Guardian characters, Dr. Mist, joins, and he's kind of like, for lack of better comparison, he's kind of like the DC Universe's Doctor Strange. He's kind of the, you know, the elder statesman of all the mystics in the DC Universe, so he's a really fun character to add to the mix. And iVampire is around for a bit in the first couple of issues as well.
Wow, Andrew Bennett.
Yeah.
Very cool. Interesting. And again, one of the things that I like about what Josh Vialkoff is doing, too, that more than ever, I think Andrew Bennett feels like a part of the DC Universe. So that's very interesting. And that's cool. I mean, these are the types of uses for these characters we haven't seen before. So I think that's really great. And it's like, embrace them as part of the DC Universe. And it sounds like that's what you're trying to do.
Yeah, I think for certain things, taking a more, I guess, vertigo approach really still does work. I think, like, for Animal Man and Swamp Thing, what me and Scott are doing is really working. But I think if you try to do that with all of these occult or dark characters, you're just going to get one flavor and it's going to get kind of old, you know? And
sure.
And just like we've already said, half the fun is just seeing these guys interact with superheroes and with DC characters, and even if they hate or aren't comfortable doing it, it's still fun to see them doing it. So I think that's why it was so cool to see those couple issues of iVampire that Josh did where Batman was in there, and that was really fun. And you know, just seeing Constantine meet Superman at some point is gonna be surreal and fun, you know.
Back to Frankenstein, I'm enjoying Ray Palmer's role in Frankenstein, and I think any old DC reader can't help but have that, you know, niggling feeling in the back of their head that, you know, when's he going to put the suit on? When's he going to put the suit on? That's okay if he doesn't, but I imagine eventually we'll get more into,
you know,
his background.
I don't know. I couldn't go as far with him as I wanted because I think that Jeff and Jim have plans for the Atom at some point. And I don't even know what those plans are. So my marching orders were just kind of, you can use Ray, but he can't be in costume yet. So I just had some fun with that, you know. And he does use his powers a couple times, but it never as the Atom. So it's kind of, it's good. You kind of get a prehistory of the Atom.
Yes.
If he does ever become the Atom, he'll already be this character that has some development to him, you know.
Very cool, man. Well, that's the thing. I really have enjoyed the ride on Frankenstein, and as you said, Matt's a great guy to hand off to. So that'll be fun to see. And as we handle Justice League Dark, I mean, that's like you said. I think you've whet our appetites. We've given us some stuff to think about, and also put that together with the preview information that we've gotten so far. And I think we're in for a neat ride there. All right, let's hit some of the dark stuff because first, Animal Man. I want to go back a couple issues to the John Paul Leon issue where we finally see Buddy's movie. He teased us with it in the first issue. on that. By the way, and I really let's take it all the way back to that first issue. What a great idea of doing that magazine front page to kind of give us a good setup. And I just appreciated the almost mixed media storytelling that you did with that very first issue.
Yeah, well, I mean, like the Animal Man character has sort of this weird history of, you know, the Grammars and stuff and everything, of having kind of this metafictional element to him anyway. And I thought I wanted to do something with that, but not just repeat what Grant did. I didn't want to, like, you know, make myself a character in the book or make him a fictional, you know, I didn't want to redo the same thing, but I thought that was a fun way to kind of, yeah, having me write the, or, you know, being the interviewer and Travel being the illustrator of the magazine article was a fun nod. So, and also I thought those first issues, it was really important to make them accessible so that anyone could pick them up and figure out who the character is right away. And I thought that was a really fun way to do it, just sort of in this conversational interview, you know.
Understood.
And moving forward with the John Paul Leon issue, always happy to see John come in.
Yeah, he's
Yeah, what an incredible artist. Perfect choice for this Red Thunder movie. So, yeah, I mean, like, because it is a movie, and obviously it's still in comic book form, how different was your scripting to John to do this kind of interesting presentation for issue 5, or issue 6, excuse me?
I don't know that I changed my scripting style too much, because I think John Paul understood the conceit of the issue, so I knew he would take it visually in that direction anyway and try to make it look a little bit more cinematic. And then you just, I had sort of like the framing sequence where, the exit sequence where Cliff's batteries run out and you realize you're watching it on his iPhone, so I knew that would work. And but if anything, that was kind of, you know, just a fun way to create this character in the Red Thunder character that was, had echoes of Buddy Baker in him, but it was almost like, what could happen to Buddy if everything went wrong, you know? If the things keep going the way they're going, and if he ends up losing his family and losing Ellen and stuff, this is the kind of guy he'll end up being, you know? And so it's almost like a warning to him of what could happen. So that was sort of the interesting thing for me on that, in that issue.
Very cool. And yeah, let's talk about Cliff for a second, because we're getting a bit more focus with him in issue 6 and 7. Well, that almost jealousy of his sister, obviously, being able to tap into the right way. You know, Buddy's been able to tap into his animal and stuff. I think it's always tough when superheroes, I think, have kids and a wife. And I think we've seen both good examples of that and bad. And your interpretation of Baker's family is definitely different from what Grant did. It's a continuation in a lot of ways, and I think an evolution. Even also what we saw in Jerry Conway's future Last Days of Animal Man story.
Right.
So I think there is a common thread there, even though we're in this new 52. I don't know how much of that is your, just by coincidence, your wish fulfillment of acknowledging the stuff that's come before you. This is a new 52, so you weren't certainly beholden to any of that. But yeah, I mean, how do you feel you're approaching the Baker family?
Just kind of two questions, but the first part is, like, when Scott and I got these assignments, Scott with Swamp Thing and me with Animal Man, it was like, we had a lot of conversations, like, what do we keep, what don't you keep, you know, because we both really revere the previous runs, the Alan Moore stuff on Swamp Thing, and then, you know, Grant and Jamie Delano's runs on Animal Man are stuff we really like, so you don't want to throw it all out, you want to be respectful of that stuff, but at the same time you have to make it new as well. So it was kind of a balancing act of adding new elements and putting your own voice in there, but still being keeping enough of it that stuff wasn't just wiped out, you know. So but you know, as in terms of how I write the Baker family, it's really odd writing that book. It's the easiest book in the world to write for me. I don't know why. I just, no effort. I never think about it. I just sit down and write a script in like a day, and it just sort of comes out. I don't know. There's just something so natural about them. I just know them, and they just kind of come out when I sit down at the, you know, it's just no work. It must just be a perfect fit for me or something. So I'm just trying not to analyze it.
Okay.
It's working, so I don't think.
Well, I like the fact that Ellen doesn't seem, you know, Ellen just gets Buddy, and I mean, it. Like, as much as some things scare her about his powers, she doesn't. There were times, I think, in previous, you know, incarnations that Alan was a little jealous, and it's just like, you know, and Alan, you know, Buddy's a good man and everything. It just, Buddy seems to be, it's funny, his family seems to be okay. It's the superhero part of his life that's complicated.
Yeah, well, that's making everything messed up. I mean, Alan is my favorite character in that book in a lot of ways. I think she's a really great, I think she's an interesting and unique character in that she's a really strong female character in a comic book, but she doesn't wear a costume. She's not, you know, she has no power. She's just like a normal woman. But in a lot of ways, she's really, you know, the backbone of that family and of that book. Without her, they would fall apart immediately. You know, if it was, if Buddy was left alone to raise those kids, it would be a disaster. They would, you know, she really is the strength, even though he's the one that, you know, is supposed to be the hero or whatever. So she's a lot of fun to write. And I mean, they all kind of have their own take. Cliff can come off at first glance as sort of this whiny brat, you know, but I think a lot of the readers can understand where it's coming from because he is just a kid. And, you know, his sister's getting all these superpowers and having all these adventures. And he's just sort of stuck in the RV with his mom. So
right.
Of course he's going to be like, you know, annoying and bitching and stuff.
And he's left out. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they all have something very unique that you can kind of hook into. And then the fun thing is to see how all those sort of personality traits change as this sort of epic storyline unfolds, and how much more can Ellen take, you know, even though she understands Buddy and gets it, how much more is she willing to put up with, and how many more times can he put his children in danger before she says that's enough, you know? And these are all things that are going to come to a head eventually. And, you know, the status quo that the book starts out as and the family starts out as is definitely going to change, you know, and evolve as the book goes on. So.
Understood. And good tortured fever dream that we see in issue 7 for Buddy, and get a bunch of Zapruder film-like clues to possibly what we're going to be seeing ahead as he gets closer to his encounter with Alec Holland.
There's definitely some big reveals there of things that are to come. So me and Scott it's no secret we have this huge storyline planned, and there's a lot of fun stuff coming in there. I wish I could start talking about spill the beans, but it's going to be pretty cool. I just wrote the first chapter of our crossover, and it's kind of a relief to finally get to it because we've been talking about it for so long, you know, and it was really fun, and it was really fun to write Swamp Thing as well.
Excellent. Tell me at least, and you don't have to go into plot points, but just in terms of the straight-up technical things, how many issues will the crossover be? Can you tell that, or is that even...
Yeah, no, I think it starts in issue 12 in each book, and that's sort of like a prelude to the actual storyline we're doing. It kind of sets it up. So issue 12 of each book, and those are really the only two that fans have to read, part one, part two, you know? And then after that, the crossover, or the storyline that we're building towards, it's called Dead World, and that's when that begins in issue 13 of each book. And I right now it's either going to go to issue 16 or 17. It's just going to, once we get closer and start getting into the actual scripting of those first couple chapters, we'll get a better sense of pacing. But yeah, so, you know, somewhere around 5 or 6 issues in each title.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, you know, this notion of the red and the green, I don't know how much you can tell us without spoiling about the origins of that portion, because I don't think it was ever, was it ever, really, it's been a while since I've read the Morrison and Delano stuff. Is that, you know, something you came up with, or are those threads that were...
It was never in Morrison stuff, I don't think, but Delano was the one who came up with that name, the Red, and you actually see Buddy go into the Red at one point in this really amazing sequence that Steve Pugh drew, which is amazing because Steve's the artist now on the book. And
yeah.
Steve actually gave me the original art from that sequence from the old series, which was amazing. But yeah, so Jamie kind of coined the term, and a lot of the concepts, he even started hinting at Maxine having powers and things like that. So it really, that was a lot of stuff where I just kind of picked up threads he was sort of teasing or introducing, and then just expanded on them, you know, and turned it into this kind of big epic sprawling kind of thing with the red and the green and now the rot. So but we'll see a little more of the history of the rot and the red and the green in the annual, the Animal Man annual, which comes out in April. And that was awesome because I got to do, was like a 40-page original story, so it's almost like this mini graphic novel, you know, that I got to do. And you see in that story, we get to see sort of an earlier adventure, an earlier incarnation of Swamp Thing and Animal Man teaming up for the first time at the turn of the century to fight the Rot when it first tried to invade Earth. And it's super fun. Yeah, so you get to see some of the history of it there, and then, you know, as the story unfolds, you're really going to get a sense of things. And I mean, I better stop talking. I'm going to start spilling.
How many different annuals are you doing for your various series?
Just as far as I know, I'm just doing Animal Man right now. Animal Man. Yeah, I haven't been told about a JL Dark one yet. So I don't know if there are plans for that. I know Scott's doing a Swamp Thing annual as well.
Yes.
They're not all coming out the same month. So like Scott's, I think, comes out later in the summer, whereas the Animal Man one comes out in April or May.
Very cool. How'd you guys become friends?
I don't know.
Where'd you guys first meet?
I was doing Sweet Tooth, and then I think American Vampire got approved and stuff right at, you know, in the early days of Sweet Tooth had already begun. So Scott kind of emailed me one day just introducing himself, saying how excited he was to be part of Vertigo and working with me and how he liked Sweet Tooth. So I kind of, that was just an email intro that we kind of had a few years ago. And then the real thing that happened was when I started doing Superboy and he got Detective Comics, DC offered us both exclusive contracts at the same time. And neither of us had any experience with this kind of thing or what to expect. And so we just called each other up to kind of compare notes. And then that's just when our friendship started. We just clicked right away, and we just, you know, just started calling each other all the time. And now, you know, we just talk a few times a week now. So.
Fantastic. Are you going to be going to Emerald City or?
I'm skipping Emerald this year. I'm going to Stumptown about a week or two later.
Fantastic.
So yeah, I try to switch which conventions I do, you know, kind of rotate them, because I find if you do the same one year after year, you kind of get the same people, and then, you know, you kind of water down your fan base that way. And it's fun to do new shows too, so I'm going to do Heroes and Stumptown this year.
Wow, so I guess no C2E2 then either.
No, that next year definitely I'll do that.
Okay,
one.
No worries, man. Well, you know, we always want to see you in Chicago, but I'm sure I'll see you in San Diego, if not.
I love Chicago. Yeah, San Diego I always go to. So.
Very good. Okay, good deal. So, yeah, what else convention-wise for the year?
Yeah, just those three, and then I'm going overseas in the fall to Spain in September and Germany in October, so that's going to be really exciting.
Fantastic. That's great. How is this stuff playing overseas? I would imagine probably.
I don't know. I know Sweet Tooth's just it's being printed in Germany this fall, so that's why I was invited over there. It's actually going to be their free comic book day comic, Sweet Tooth number one in Germany. Yeah, isn't that weird? So
that's great.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. So I guess I'll find out. You know, I don't know. I went to my first sort of experience going abroad was in the fall. I went to England, but I mean I'm already familiar with a lot of the English fans and artists and stuff, so that wasn't a huge departure for me, but it'll be interesting going to like Germany and Spain, where I don't know what kind of reception my work has there, you know?
Okay. Do you think you were saying earlier that you're surprised at how well you're doing writing lighter stuff and certainly more mainstream stuff for DC as you get those assignments. Do you think, and I don't mean to disrupt your process, but do you think any of that lightness is invading books like Animal Man and Sweet Tooth and some of these other things?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's just a matter of balance. You know, you don't want to write three versions of the same book, you know?
Absolutely.
And I think Sweet Tooth and Animal Man have a lot of similarities, but there's enough differences that I can get away with that. But you don't want to write another book with the same mood, the same tone, you know? So the natural thing is to go to something a lot lighter and funner just to balance things. And I don't know. I think I like writing both kind of moods, you know? I like writing really dark and disturbing stuff, but I can't do it all the time or else, you know, you just become a one-trick pony. So you got to kind of push yourself to explore new ground and stuff.
Well, and I think that's interesting, too, that Animal Man and Sweet Tooth do kind of, in general terms, play in the same areas. But at first I was going to say that I thought Sweet Tooth was a much more intimate book. But then I think, no, Animal Man, certainly with the family focus, has a lot of intimacy in it as well.
Yeah,
in terms of, you know, just kind of that tight cast of characters.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of similarities, you know. even thematically, there's a lot of stuff, just the family and things like that, that I'm doing in both books. So, but yeah, and then again, there's enough differences that they're both unique, I think, too.
True. Well, and let's switch to Sweet Tooth. I'm glad to see Gus. It looks like at the end of the most recent issue, is literally standing on his own 2 feet and is slightly armed for war, as we see the weapon in his hand at the last page. But yeah, you know, honestly, as I've told you before, you tear my hair out my heart out every time I read Sweet Tooth. I'm like, oh, these poor kids, little Bobby, you're hurting me. Lucy, all these kids. Oh my God, it's just it's great. It's very fun, and it's this dark, sad story, but incredibly compelling. Those elements of, and forgive me, but Lost has to come to mind.
Yeah, for
with,
sure.
With some of your locations and sequels.
Yeah, I think the current storyline that's sort of wrapping up now, the stuff with the dam and Project Evergreen and all that stuff, that was very Lost influenced. I'm not gonna lie. I mean, I was watching Lost while I was working on the end of the first arc of Sweet Tooth. Is when Lost, the finale and stuff, was on, so I rewatched it all, and I think it had a huge influence on that second arc with Project Evergreen and stuff. But I think I needed to do that, something like that, in order to kind of have a middle act, you know, because before that I had the beginning planned out and I know the ending, but sort of that middle section was left open. So yeah, but anyways, I think what we're coming to now is sort of the end of the second act, if we look at the whole thing as a big three-act story. So,
gotcha.
And yeah, and it's definitely Gus now in his adolescence. You know, he's not the innocent anymore. He's becoming more and more like Jeppard, but he's still struggling, trying not to cross those lines that Jeppard crossed. And yeah, it's going to be... I know where it's going, so it's interesting to see all the stuff that I planned out a couple of years ago actually happening, because I thought, you know, when that book launched from Vertigo, I expected it to last about 6 issues before we got canceled. So I'm just thankful that I get to tell the whole story that I kind of dreamed of telling.
That's great, and that was going to be my next question, was just in terms of, you know, you are getting to tell it in the pace that you want, and I'm glad that there is the readership that it is, that it's allowing you to tell this story in the pace that you wanted to. I was just talking to John Rood and Bob Wayne, and that's the thing. I think there's an imperative to sales and meeting, you know, sales expectations more than ever. I mean, there always is that. But it just seems like for the longest time, and again, this is just a reader's perspective, that Vertigo books were allowed to, you know, tell these very long, complicated stories because, A, the trade sales justified it. And again, it just kind of made them a different animal of storytelling rather than what we get in, you know, mainstream superhero fare. So do you feel now that, you know, do you think that the rules have changed? I mean, I think you're being allowed to, with Sweet Tooth, tell the story that you are. I know Jason Aaron is wrapping up Scalped. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if, without going into specifics of whatever future things you have on the drawing board, if, you know, long-term storytelling is still part of Vertigo's big plan.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. These are all discussions that happen that I'm not privy to, you know, so I don't know. I mean, I know that I'm allowed to kind of do what I want to do with Sweet Tooth, but that's because sales are warranting it, you know.
Sure.
The monthly sell don't sell great, but the trades sell really, really well. So, I mean, it is worth it to them to let me do that. But, I mean, I don't know if we've seen the last of the days where Vertigo series go for, like, you know, 60, 70, 80 issues or not. I don't know that. I think just more and more you're going to see people coming in and doing stuff that's more like 8, 9 issue, 10 issue things, kind of like what Azzarello is doing with Spaceman or, you know, Joe the Barbarian stuff, just because I think writers and stuff like to be able to tell a complete story. And when you launch a monthly, there's always that uncertainty, you know. You build this world and you put everything into it, but you might not be able to take it where you want to. So if you kind of, you know, plan things out on a bit of a smaller, more manageable scale, at least you're guaranteed to be able to tell the story you want to tell. And I know that's something I'll think about, even though Sweet Tooth, you know, was able to go as long as it goes. My next thing might not be, so I'll be conscious, because I can't imagine telling a story without being able to tell the ending, you know.
Understood. And is this current arc in Sweet Tooth, is it only 3 chapters, this story that we're currently in right now, or is it a little bit longer?
I think it was 4. It's hard to remember because they all sort of blur together. But I believe this one's 4. So it ends with issue 33 or something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
And then I have 2 standalone issues. One is like a callback to the issue I did that was sideways storybook kind of stuff.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. Go on, please.
Yeah, I'm doing another one of those in issue 33. So it's kind of like, you know, that issue sort of the first time happened between the first and second kind of major storylines, and now between the second and third, we're going to get another one of those kind of storybooky kind of interludes, which was a lot of fun to do. And then issue 34, we sort of get the secret origin of the bad guy, Abbott, finally, and his brother, Johnny, and Nate Powell's drawing that issue, which is really cool. And then issue 35, I'm back, and I kind of kick into high gear, and they all head towards Alaska, and you know, everything I've been kind of building starts to unfold, so it's sort of the end game is approaching for sure.
Very cool, man. No, it's very interesting, and yeah, I mean, things are staying creepy, but it seems like some of the answers are slowly coming to us, so.
Oh yeah, I mean, in terms of answers, too, I should say, like, issue 35 that I'm going to draw next, that's like the big reveal issue, you know, it's the mystery of the plague, the mystery of the hybrids, all of it is just, it's revealed finally, so, and that's not the end of the series by any means, but, you know, I always said from the start that the mystery about the kids and the plague and stuff was never really the driving force of the book, so it wasn't like a series that was built around the mystery, and once the mystery's out, that's the end of the series. So I wanted to kind of get that out of the way before the big final act, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah, issue 35, you kind of get it all.
I have a feeling we're going to have to talk in a couple of months, not only for Sweet Tooth, but obviously for Justice League Dark to have gotten started, and we can kind of settle into where you are with these things. Plus, you've got a Top Shelf book coming up?
Yeah, I have a new graphic novel in July in San Diego. It's going to debut from Top Shelf. It's kind of, I guess in a lot of ways, it's my follow-up to Essex County. Just, you know, not that it's the same characters or anything, but it's just sort of aesthetically and thematically and stuff, it's probably the closest thing to Essex County that I've done since. It's a big, self-contained, 250-page book. It's called The Underwater Welder, and it's got a new introduction by Damon Lindelof from Lost, and I don't know, I'm really excited about it. It's kind of like a really heart-wrenching Twilight Zone episode is how I describe it. You know, it's this deep-sea diver working on an oil rig off the coast of a small coastal town, and him and his wife live in this town, and they're expecting their first child, and he's kind of feeling a lot of pressure about impending fatherhood and about just, you know, the obvious pressures of his work, which is very dangerous, and it all kind of comes to a head while he's diving under the sea one day, and when he surfaces, the world that he emerges into is a very different world from the one he left, and he kind of has to find his way back, and it's a kind of mysterious, moody sort of character piece about fatherhood and parenthood and stuff.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah. Awesome. Unbelievable, Jeff, as always. I am stunned by the output, and I'm really pleased that, like I said, that people are gravitating to these books. I didn't ask. I'm curious. I know Animal Man is certainly a critical darling, and everyone's been raving about that. How is Frankenstein doing?
Critically or commercially, I'm not, you know, I don't know. I don't know what DC's expectations are for the books at this point, but I know it's clearly not selling as well as Animal Man. I don't know what the cutoff point is for their series right now, but, you know, I just hope Matt gets a healthy chance to do a few issues, and I would implore anyone who's been kind of hearing about the book or whatever to definitely check it out, because some of these books might not be around for a long time unless, you know, sales kind of pick up and stuff. So
well, I understand, and that's the thing. I think so much focus has been happening on the established characters, mm-hmm. the Resurrection Man's, and even though Resurrection Man is an old character, but it's, I think, these newer books that, you know, DC really took a chance on to give their own series to some of these characters are really the ones that are the most interesting. And obviously, because you guys have this clean slate to play with and stuff, and I'm telling you, man, Frankenstein is hands down just a blast every month, and it's so much fun, and the characters are great. I love it, and yeah, I am excited to see that go on. I was a little disappointed because it still seems like, you know, you're just getting started, having only the first three Flashpoint issues, and then, you know, the nine issues that you're going to do.
Yeah, but like I said, I'm not done with that character. He's gonna...
Understood.
There is a plan, without giving anything away. I'm going to be writing that character a lot more very soon. So.
Okay. And I would say, given what you've described with Justice League Dark, and what we know from Frankenstein and Shade, I really think that people that maybe liked Shadow Pact and stuff like that, but maybe were, you know, again, those were books that didn't quite find their audience. I really think you're playing in the same milieu, but doing it in a different way that... There's a bit more action and adventure, I think, in your books than, say, something like Shadow Pact, which I really loved. I thought Bill Willingham
had
a great sense of humor in those books. I think you've got a good balance of good characterization in Frankenstein and really interesting adventure stories as well. So I'll join you and say, if you haven't been reading Frankenstein, definitely pick up when they are traded, or go through the back issues or the digital issues. And certainly... I'm a big fan of Matt's as well, and I can't wait to see what Matt's going to be doing with Frankenstein.
Yeah, it's really fun stuff. His cell lines were really surprised me. They were really cool. So.
But yeah. Animal Man, obviously, everything's good, and you know.
Animal Man and Swamp Thing are outperforming what they ever expected those books to do.
Isn't that great? Fantastic.
It's really great, and you know, I thought when we first started working on it, I felt like we were doing something really good, and it's so rewarding to see that kind of. See fans respond, and for a book like that to actually be commercially successful as well, you know, it's doing quite well. So, if I have my way, I'll write that book as long as I can. But I'd love to be. I definitely have to beat Morrison's 26 issues, and then we'll go after that. I'll aim at Delano. I think he did like 40 something.
That's true. Oh my God, I forgot how many more issues Jamie did. That's a good point.
Either 40 or 60. I can't remember. He did a lot, anyways.
And then my hope with you guys, much like, you know, Brian Bendis 10 years ago, that newcomers to your stuff through the mainstream stuff might reach back and look at Essex County and some of your original graphic novels and stuff. I don't know if that's happening anecdotally.
You know, you hope that that happens, but it's hard to say. I mean, I don't know that there's been a huge upswing in Sweet Tooth sales since Animal Man kind of hit, but...
Reach for the Nobody, for example.
Yeah, you don't see it in the monthly books, but I feel like the trades are maybe selling a bit more briskly now because of Animal Man. And I'm the kind of guy that follows creators around more than characters, so, and I think that's happening more and more. So I think you will see more people following, like, you know, my indie stuff. And it'll be kind of interesting to see how the new graphic novel from Top Shelf does compared to how Essex County did when it first came out. My profile's changed so much since then.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, my man, I appreciate the time, and if we can, I'd really love to talk in a few months. And really, I'd love to get you and Scott on together.
Yeah, that would be fun. Maybe right before the crossover stuff really kicks in, that way we can do something. That'd be fun.
Very good. But continued success, dude. Honestly, I really think that, you know, you're on a hell of a streak, and I think it continues this year with the books that you're currently writing, and really looking forward to JLA Dark. Or whatever. Justice League Dark.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I'm just really grateful for the support that books have been getting and stuff, and it's been, you know, really fun to be able to do my creator-owned stuff and balance it with the DC stuff. It's, you know, I can't ask for much more than that.
Well done, sir. Well, back to your drafting board. I know you're a busy man, and as always, I appreciate the time that we spend, and let's make sure in a couple months that we check back in.
Sounds great, John. Thanks.
I'm sure we'll catch up with Jeff Lemire, and I'm sure next time we'll have better fidelity. So thanks for, you know, dealing with that. Like I said, I don't think it was that much of a tune-out, if any tune-out at all. Again, it sounded like we were outside. Now, this conversation sounds like we're indoors. It's Nunzio DeFilippis and Christina Weir, a great writing team who've had wonderful success in television writing, but also have been doing great comic book work. You might remember them from the Jumper prequel. They also did the great series Skinwalker for Oni Press with Brian Hurt, Three Strikes, another great crime novel. They've got the Free Comic Book Day book, Bad Medicine, and we're going to be talking about that in the second portion of our conversation. But to start things off, they do a lot of great young adult writing with female leads, and we're here to talk about those to begin with. So here's our conversation with Christina Weir and Nunzio DeFilippis on Word Balloon.
Our newest book is going to be like a week and a half, 2 weeks away from release.
Is that Play Ball or is that the other one?
That's Avalon Chronicles.
That's out of, okay.
Which will be hot off the presses for Emerald City, so we will be hyping that.
Awesome.
So, yes, we've got Avalon Chronicles in March, and then Play Ball in April, and Bad Medicine in May, so it's a nice little lineup.
There you go.
If last year was the year without cons for us, because last year was the year where everything we were working on was waiting on an artist to finish, like the timing of everything wound up in 2012.
That's fantastic.
So, you know, this is the year that we then turn around and go to a lot of conventions and do as much as we can to support these books.
So, very cool. So what is your convention schedule going to be for the year?
Well, it's definitely Emerald City. We'll probably be in at San Diego for a day or two. We're thinking about going to New York, and we'll see beyond that. We haven't really figured out beyond that. But where our publishers want us to go, we will go.
Excellent. Excellent. I know Oni always has a nice presence in New York and certainly San Diego. So, and we were saying as we were getting started, this is going to be our first Emerald City, all of us. So that'll be exciting in a couple of weeks.
And yeah, as we were saying, everyone talks about how great a show that is. And maybe it's local pride because we know so many people in Portland. So they love it because it's so close. But they do talk about how there's a sort of a purity to the show and there's more direct contact with the fans because it's not quite as out of control, crazy as San Diego is.
But, sure, and even New York is getting that way too.
But then we went once to when Wizard World had the Long Beach Con, and that was like a ghost town. There was tumbleweed blowing through the convention center, and so you know you want something that falls in between the madness of San Diego and the absolute like where is everybody of a show like that. And so we hear that Emerald City is just the right size and just like a lot of enthusiasm, but not a lot of, you know, feeling like you're getting crushed.
Yeah, the chill cons seem to be that remain chilled cons are, you know, Emerald City, and it sounds like Baltimore is still a good but laid back con. Heroes certainly.
And
heard good things about Heroes.
And Heroes in Baltimore would be fun for us to check out. And really, with the teaching that I'm doing and the sort of the crazy schedule of nearly full-time screenwriting teaching, I don't know how many of these we can go to, but we're going to try and hit as many as we can.
Very cool. Yeah, and again, off the air, you were telling me that you're doing screenwriting teaching at the L.A. branch of the New York Film Academy?
That's correct. The New York Film Academy has, in the States, it's international, so but it's got a New York office and a Los Angeles office, and it's right on the Universal lot and the Warner's lot. It's right where the two of them meet. So it's this really sort of hands-on film school. And it's been interesting to teach there more full-time and start becoming part of a screenwriting faculty and go to curriculum meetings and things like that. It's still teaching on an adjunct level where I take the courses they offer me. It's not a regular job in the same way. And it's not the sort of institution that has a whole lot of full-time positions, but they keep giving me enough courses that I'm effectively full-time.
That's great. So Christina, is that, you know, sticking you with more the, you know, hands-on
writing? I'm chained to the computer at home, writing away all by myself.
It has been a weird shift in how we write. We always do everything together. We sit, we plot together, then we write together, then we rewrite together. We're sort of freakishly codependent, even creatively. but with this, first drafts have become exclusively her domain. We plot everything together still. We have to because it has to feel like it's both of ours. I would not do this teaching if it prevented me from doing that part.
Understood.
But she then sits and she has to turn everything into the first draft, and then I sort of get to come back in.
In his teacher mode now and give me notes.
I do not give notes.
I'm just kidding.
It's very nice.
I do a rough first draft and then sort of put it back in front of him and be like, okay, you know, make it yours now, make it better, you know, make it dance.
Tell me about Avalon Chronicles. That's the first book. And Christina, by all means, you had the first draft. So give me the pitch, Christina. Awesome.
Well, Avalon Chronicles is a project very near and dear to our hearts because we originally released the first volume several years back. And unfortunately, the artist sort of went her own way after volume one. And we had all these stories left to tell and no artist to draw it. So we spent a good many years in search of the perfect artist. And we're fortunate enough to meet Emma Vicelli, how many years ago? A year ago? A year and a half ago? A
couple years ago. And we didn't want to release a volume two really far away from volume one. We also, Emma does a lot of her own stuff too, where she writes and illustrates. So we wanted her on board as a full collaborator, not as someone who was just work for hire. So okay. we went back to the first volume and we opened it up to her and said, what would you change?
Well, actually, first we went to Oni and looked at them very sweetly, and they agreed to redo Volume 1, to let Emma redraw Volume 1.
And that's all on her. She's just so good that they figured, yeah, we could re-release the book, and it would be something new and different and exciting with her. So then we brought it back to her, and surprisingly, she didn't change a lot of the structure of it, but a lot of the seeds of what we were doing required us going back and making minor changes to the story. And then the characters were completely redesigned based on where we were going to take them. And so this first volume, the book had been called Once in a Blue Moon a ways back, but this is the completely and utterly revamped Once in a Blue Moon that really sets up what we always wanted to do with the story and what we now want to do with the story after having worked with Emma.
The story is, it's Aislinn Finn, who was always read to by her parents at night when she was young, and they used to read her from this great fantasy book called The Avalon Chronicles. And then one day her parents went off for the weekend and only her mom came back, and she had no father anymore. And her mom was very serious and said, you know, no more fantasy in your life. And the real world is a tough, hard place. And the sooner you learn that, the better. And then we flash forward 8 years to Aislinn being a teenager and one day coming across this strange and magical book that is the sequel to the book she read as a kid. And she gets sucked into it and into this wonderful fantasy world and is off on a quest to find her father, who may or may not be dead.
And the world is sort of overrun by this evil warlord. But in the stories that she read when she was a kid, there was a magical dragon knight, the one person who could ride a dragon. So in the first volume, she has to sort of learn how she fits in, because everyone is waiting for her and says, you are the Dragon Knight. And so she starts to realize that this might be where her father disappeared to. She also starts to realize if she's going to be the new Dragon Knight, she has to find and wake the last of the dragons, because this warlord has slaughtered the rest of the dragons. So she has to find the last one, ride it, and start a revolution while simultaneously figuring out why she's important and what her father's role is and what all of it means.
Very cool. And yes, Once in a Blue Moon has a double meaning, because we'll learn that in the book.
And it's really amazing if, you know, I mean, obviously comics are a visual medium and everyone places a lot of importance on the artist, but I don't, it's like, it feels so tangible when you look at this book and realize it's an entirely different beast because of this new artist that we have on it. And Emma's just done wonderful, wonderful things with it.
There's an apples and oranges thing, so it's not any slam on the artist of the original version. But her art, we can no longer imagine this story being done by anyone else.
Very cool. And is she working now on Volume 2?
She is.
How many books do you see happening in the Avalon Chronicles? Or is this really ongoing and you've got, you know, tons of stories waiting with us?
It could be ongoing, but we have mapped 4 right now. We could change our mind and open things up, but we have it planned so that if we only do the 4, it will be a complete story, beginning, middle, and end.
It's funny because your 7C stuff is very fantasy-driven. A lot of your Oni stuff is very grounded in reality, and I imagine we're getting a mix when these two worlds collide.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the story of someone being pulled into a fantasy world or even into a storybook, you know, is nothing that we've invented. It's been done before.
Sure.
What we tried to do here that we thought would be a fun new twist is she can go back and forth a lot more often than the characters in these stories usually do.
I see.
So it really matches up the real world and the storybook world. And there's some of that in Volume 1. She goes back and forth a couple of times. there's more of it in volume two where we come back and we see that the story is almost equally important back home.
Christina, I would assume that a lot of this, the stuff that you guys play with a lot of times, I wonder, because you do so much stuff with young women as your protagonist, is something that, you know, might be some sort of wish fulfillment in some sense. I mean, you know, or do you live vicariously through them? I mean, how much of that do you feel is, you know, you coming through, and how much is Nunes tapping into his own little inner little world?
It's totally awesome to ride a dragon, though I'd probably be scared to death at the same time. I'm not nearly as brave as the characters rewrite. I suppose there's a little bit of wish fulfillment or tapping this up. I suppose I'm lucky that Nunzio is willing to indulge in a lot of these various stories and ideas that we have.
The other thing to remember is that on both sides of our family, like her side and my side, but in particular my side, the girls seem to outnumber the boys when it comes to children.
Okay.
True, nieces. We have a lot of nieces.
There are more nieces than nephews. There are goddaughters. I partially like writing these things because I want those girls to read comics, because I want those girls to have stories where they don't have to root for a little boy, where they can root for a little girl to save the kingdom instead. Or they can watch Luna in Amazing Agent Luna be the supreme butt-kicking secret agent and also be a teenage girl. So,
gotcha.
However, I was very pleased to discover that my 12-year-old nephew seems to be our number one fan when it comes to Amazing Agent Luna. He eats those books up.
And that's really cool.
I tagged him for it.
No, that's fantastic. Well, that's the thing, because obviously you've just answered my question, because I was going to say, I know you guys don't have kids, but I know a lot of your friends do, and it's, do you kind of sidle up and listen to conversations? Because I always find, now again, this coming from a middle-aged man, but it seems to me that your teenage characters ring true. So, I mean, I think you know.
Say.
I don't know, honestly.
I think that's because Christina is still a teenager at heart.
There you go.
It could be. I think I have an inner teen girl trapped in me somewhere.
I think that's what was interesting in checking out this current crop of books, because the problems they have seem to ring true, and I think the dialogue does.
Excellent to hear. We used to drive our agent crazy because we would jump from genre to genre, and she's like, I can't market you in Hollywood when you do that. It's been one of the beauties of working in comics, though, is because at Seven Seas and Oni and whatnot, we can tell just every type of story that pops into our head.
Yeah, we can go from play ball. We can go from fantasy in the Avalon Chronicles to a sort of young adult or teen girl coming of age story with sports in play ball to
horror
pure horror procedural. With Bad Medicine, and the guys at Oni are like, whatever, just keep them coming.
I've enjoyed the various genres you've jumped to, even Jumper, when you got to do the prequel to the, you know, a much better story than, unfortunately, the movie, but what are you going to do? Frenemy of the State, of course.
And Frenemy, just by way of keeping the updates going, Frenemy continues its path towards development as a feature film.
Excellent.
Rashida Jones, who brought the original story idea to us and then worked, you know, hand in hand with us, and who is wonderfully sweet and remarkably talented, he is writing the screenplay to that, which, you know, as we are screenwriters, would be sad if it weren't Rashida, but love Rashida, and we know she loves the book, so, you know, she's been part of every stage of the writing of it, so it's in good hands, and hopefully Universal and Imagine will be making a decision sometime this year as to whether this development continues and goes into, you know, production.
You mentioned play ball, and I do want to talk about that, especially with baseball season coming up. I have to say, of the three, that's the one I gravitated to the most, because I really like that. It's, you know, it's a very simple but earnest and the kind of story that I think a young teen would kind of gravitate to. Tell people about play ball.
Play ball is the story of the teenage girl, Dashiell Brody, who loves baseball with a huge passion. But she has always gone to an all-girls school where they only had a softball team. So when she and her mom and sister move cross-country, she and her sister are now in a school where they have a baseball team. And she wants to try out for it, saying that there's nowhere in the rules that say that it's boys only. And this, you know, raises a lot of eyebrows. People get upset and, you know, tension issues.
I think you guys did a great job of conveying the sport on page, and these characters ring true. I think the dynamic between her older sister and herself, and her mother too, for that matter. I think it's all, you know, very realistic, and it's the good kind of story that I think any parent would give to their young daughter to say, no, you can do this.
It seems to be being received well so far in advanced reviews, which we're very pleased with. And we were paired with a wonderful artist, Jackie Lewis, who this, I think, was her first major project.
Yeah, this is her first major book, and it will not be her last.
Very impressive, absolutely.
And she captured it. The thing about Jackie is she wasn't that much of a baseball fan when we started.
I don't think she really knew anything about baseball, and we sort of threw all this stuff at her.
But the characters and the personas and the dynamics and the emotions at play, when she did character designs, everything that she did when she found out about this book and found out that they were considering her for this book to get the book, we absolutely knew that she was the person for the book. And the baseball stuff, we just send her video clips, or we would send her links. We would do, and like all good artists, she studied, she learned, she got it right. The nailing the characters and getting the tone, that was so much more important to us. And it really is she seems like the perfect artist for the book now. Despite the fact that like the earlier in the process, we would be like, this is how they bunt. We'd send a video of her bunting, and she'd be like, awesome. And then we'd see it on the page. You know, I love baseball. I've always loved baseball. And Christina loves it, maybe not quite as much as me, but
I love baseball. It's just you're a little bit more OCD about baseball.
I'm incredibly OCD about baseball.
Really? All right. Fantasy league all ready and everything?
No. I can't do fantasy because I root for teams and I don't like singling out players. So I would buy all the Yankees. And some of them aren't good enough for a fantasy league, you know. I don't want to buy someone from a rival team and then root for that guy to hit a home run when I really don't want him to. So I just have to watch all the games obsessively.
See, and I'm the kind of fan that, unfortunately, then I got involved with sports radio, and I got to see behind the curtain so much. And also, just unfortunately, it's really different than when we were all kids, because there, you know, the likelihood of one player being part of a team for his career is really, you know, not the norm anymore. It really is a rare thing. And, you know, just because of that, as much as I've grown up in Chicago and I am still a Cubs fan, I really have, you know, I've kind of, I don't know, my heart's got hardened. I honestly, I can't engage in a full season anymore. So,
baseball has finally broken the Cubs fan. That's a
yeah. Surprise. It's sad but true, man. And honestly, it's like that with every sport, though.
Well,
where
I think
it's the ownership, and that's why this story is just a more pure, fun story, and it is about the game and about just a kid with the love of the game rather than, you know, the crap that you get as you get older.
Right. Well, and I think that the steroid stuff, the salaries, it's distancing itself from people in a way that I don't think they quite realize the damage that they've done to the sport. I think people are really beleaguered. I know, one of my best friends was a baseball fan when I was younger and literally has no patience for the sport anymore because of the steroid stuff.
I understand that.
The Ryan Braun news was, I think, that was a breaking point for a lot of people too, because, you know, here he is, he's cleared, but not because he didn't do it, but because of a chain of evidence. You know, like, where was chain of custody on the evidence?
Oh, America's national pastime.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? Exactly.
And that's, know. I mean, there's lots of reasons why Play Ball as a book is about a girl at a high school level as opposed to a woman attempting to join a Major League Baseball team. There are, aside from the credibility issues, like, I don't believe Major League Baseball is anywhere near ready for that, whereas I think high schools, this could happen any day in certain
– it happens – absolutely. It happens every year where you get a story like this and you've got a kid with potential. No, I think so. I think – and it's right. You're right. I mean, unfortunately, the last place where it's – still pure competition, hopefully, it's not at every high school, because there's those stories too where, you know, those are already being groomed for the college teams,
right.
And you know, the feeder system to the majors starts that early and stuff. Yeah, I that's why I appreciate that, and you know, yeah, thank God, you know, most high school competition is still, you know, at a player's level that I think, you know, average people can still enjoy.
Right.
So, it's cool.
And yeah, and exactly. It's much more relatable to keep it at high school. And I think on top of that, it, of course, allowed us to explore all of the social dynamics of being a teenager as opposed to being someone in their, you know, 19, 20 years old trying to break in with a minor league club. All of a sudden you get into – it's a different stage of life. And if you're doing a coming-of-age story about a 19-year-old, it feels a little different than a 16-year-old or a 15-year-old.
And, you know, like I always think sports – comic books are among the toughest genres to sell out there. But I would think with something like baseball, what do you do? Because I know Oni helps you guys out, but like, how do you promote this? Because this is the kind of, I think, you know, YA book that, you know, kids would be interested in if it gets into the right hands. Is there any way that Oni can, you know, put it through Scholastic beyond the traditional direct market and get it into other booksellers' hands where you might have a more direct pipeline to the kind of audience you're trying to get to?
You know, I think that's a really good question. And I think Corey, who does the publicity and marketing at Oni, would probably be better able to answer that. But I do think it's important because I think it is the type of book that can appeal to people who aren't necessarily sports fans. I mean, we do a lot to cultivate the family drama that goes along there too. And
sure.
And I think there's a lot of stuff in there for everybody. And so, yeah, you know, what we do is just, you know, when we go out there and talk about it, make sure people know that it's not just about the sport. You don't have to know baseball inside and out to enjoy it. And
I think that Oni is also, they're being very shrewd, and Corey is very shrewd. I think with books like Avalon and Play Ball that don't necessarily seem to have, I mean, Avalon being fantasy maybe more so, but they don't necessarily seem to have the local comic shop appeal of, say, Bad Medicine as horror, you know,
understood.
Drill monthly. I think that they're going for bookstores. I think they're going for libraries. And I think that that's the way to get these kids looking at comics again, is they're going to discover it in their library. They're going to find it in a bookstore. I don't know that I worry sometimes that local comic book stores, even the best run ones, chase young readers away, and in particular chase girls away. So I think that libraries and bookstores are a better place to reach teenage girls right now than the local comic book store.
Is that something you're finding locally? Because I know in Chicago, you know, we have a mixed bag. We're you know, fortunate to have as many different comic stores as we do. But then we do have ones that really do try to cater to younger audiences. You know, Challengers Comics is a perfect example. They're my friends. And they, I think, really, you know, do a really good job of not only having a kids section, but also really, yeah, trying to be mindful and really, really get good girl product out there for young girls to get into comics. I mean, they really do push hard with, you know, reading programs on Saturdays where they'll do read-alongs and things to really try and convince parents, no, this is a great way to get your kids reading.
And they've got the
product beyond the superhero stuff and the stuff that normally sells in the direct market to really cater to this young audience.
And I think,
I
think that Free Comic Book Day is a huge step. And I think that a lot of local comic book stores are aware that they need to do the outreach. And I've actually found that the shops out here, they're none of them are that, you know, Simpsons-esque comic shop guy stereotype of, you know, annoying, arrogant, obnoxious, condescending comic guy. They're all actually great, and they would love new readers. I actually just think that the dominance of the superhero publishers at those stores in terms of ordering levels is what probably keeps them out the most, is that there's this absolute fear of jumping in. And I don't know that teenage girls are as interested, and I don't think those publishers know how to reach teenage girls. I know for a fact that, you know, we've gone to these publishers and tried to work out books that would appeal to teenage readers, and they're always – the things that we try to do in books like Play Ball to get teenagers and particular teenage girls interested in the books, the way we write, that doesn't fit with the kind of storytelling that goes on in superhero books. And so they want to do the outreach, but they have to make sure that they appeal to their base customers at the beginning, you know.
Certainly.
Because if they don't get those girls and the base customer doesn't respond to what we're doing, what you get is the kind of low numbers that we got on New X-Men Academy X, you know, that it didn't hit the wider audience outside of the everyday comic readers that they wanted. And the everyday comic readers were like, where are the fights? Where are the costumes? And so we wound up neither fish nor fowl. Like, we
understood.
And so they're in a bad place, and it's not necessarily that the DC people or the Marvel people are deliberately ignoring teen girls. I just don't know if they know how to shift their business model or take a loss for enough months until these books can find a home. And I think digital is going to help them on that.
Gotcha. Now, you mentioned Free Comic Book Day. You guys are a big part of it this year with Bad Medicine.
Yeah, we're very excited that our first issue gets to launch with Free Comic Book Day.
Yeah, excellent. So, yeah, seriously, this is a good opportunity to kind of tell people beyond, you know, some of the freebies they should be looking for. Here's one that, we certainly gets the SunTrust Word Balloon recommendation. You guys always do really cool crime stuff, also stuff that has a supernatural twist. So please tell us about Bad Medicine.
Well, Bad Medicine is something we've been calling a medical horror procedural,
yeah.
A mashup of all of that. We are taking sort of supernatural horror and sci-fi tropes and examining them from a, quote, science point of view.
Yeah, what a lot of people would call pseudoscience is what they're bringing to bear. The lead character is a doctor named Randall Horn, who, after a sort of tragedy and sort of tears his life apart, he goes on a journey to understand that there was more to medicine than he in his limited Western medicine mindset could grasp. So he learns all sorts of holistic medicine or pseudoscience, what people would call pseudoscience, and he views them as real, but he treats them with true scientific analysis. And when he starts to see the world through this larger sense of science, he suddenly becomes the man best equipped to deal with things that would otherwise be considered folklore, like vampires or werewolves. We don't do vampires just because they're overdone, but we might one day get there. Ghosts, werewolves, zombies, spontaneous human combustion was on our list until Owen published Spontaneous, and we really want to leave that to Joe Harris because he's doing it so well. So we might not go spontaneous human combustion, but with demonic possession is coming up down the line.
But our first story arc is an invisible man, and Randall gets called in to look into this because he seems to be the only one who's really capable to wrap his head around it and provide an answer as to what's going on. And he slowly ends up putting a team together, and they go out to investigate weird shit.
I like it. Well, weird shit right on the cover. There's always nothing wrong with a decapitated body to start things off on Free Comic Book Day. So I have a feeling that's good, though. No, honestly, I think that's fantastic. That's that is the kind of provocative cover that I think would
make. What's great is that we've decapitated people a lot when working with Chris Mitten. He had to decapitate a guy in the very first book we worked with him on. The Tomb,
yeah.
Okay, yeah. Very fun.
So we have sort of an ongoing joke with Chris about the morbid, gross stuff we throw his way and how much glee he seems to take in drawing it.
That's fantastic. Well, you know, and Chris has certainly made a name for himself over at Oni with Wasteland as well with, and now I'm blanking, Anthony Johnson.
Yes.
So that's great. And, of course, Chris is a Chicago guy, so I'm happy that Chris is to find employment and everything. And that's all. I've forgotten about you guys with The Tomb. Because I was going to say, how'd you end up working with Chris? Totally forgot about
The Tomb. We did The Tomb with him, and then we did Past Lies with him.
Okay.
And then Anthony came along and stole him from us.
Yeah. And he was gone for the longest time. And the thing is, Chris isn't just one of our favorite artists to work with. He's probably one of our best friends in the industry.
Nice.
And we only see him at San Diego.
Oh, man. Well, don't – you know, honestly, between you guys and our mutual friend October Crafasi, there's another person that – you know, it's like, I can't believe you've never met Chris Mitten. He's from Chicago. And I'm like, no, but I love his work, and I'm always happy that he's doing well. And I haven't had him on Word Balloon yet, but I don't know why. We just don't run into the same circles, I guess. I never
one of the nicest guys in the industry. Mm-hmm. He's such a sweetheart.
That's cool. And you guys always – go ahead.
We've wanted to get back in collaboration with Chris for a really long time, but he was on Wasteland. He was doing fantastic work. We like the book. We like Anthony. So we weren't going to go to Oni and say, you know, pry him loose. We want him back. He seemed to have a home. And then I think he was looking for a change of pace. He'd been on Wasteland for a while. And
yeah.
He had always talked about when it came time to leave, he wanted to find something else to do with us. And we had Bad Medicine in development, and Oni was looking for an artist. And so James Lucas Jones, the editor-in-chief there, was like, this is the perfect match. And Chris is also the perfect artist for this book because of the his style is perfectly matched to the stories we're telling.
Absolutely. The weirdness and everything. And he has a very cool, realistic style for people who haven't read Wasteland or The Tomb or your other past lives as well. So I think it is a good match. And, you know, I was going to say, going back to things like did Brian Hurt do Three Strikes with you, or was it Skinwalkers that he
both,
did?
Both of them.
Oh, there you go.
And Jumper.
And Jumper, of course. Okay. Because, yeah, I mean, that's the thing.
We tend to work with artists that we then befriend and try to keep them around. Of course, Brian is working on some, you know, big books and good books, The Damned before it, and now Six Gun. And so he is, alas, unavailable for us, but we would happily work with Brian Hurt again in a heartbeat. He's a great guy, too.
And I'm glad that Oni is continuing with Bad Medicine the same way that they did with Six Gun, which became such a big hit through Free Comic Book Day.
Mm-hmm.
And I sense that this could be, you know, the start of one of those.
It's a little nerve-wracking. I feel like we have big shoes to fill because Six Gun was just such a runaway success, and they're doing fabulous stuff. And now I feel like, you know, we have to deliver up to the same caliber.
And not only that, but they're using the same path to try and launch us, which we love. We love the fact that Oni has gotten behind this so much, and they know that this method worked with Six Gun. It helped it find its audience. So we know that they're doing everything in their power to make this book succeed. So we are trying desperately to nail every issue. We're also writing this book at a pace that is very different from books that we've done in the past. The stories move much faster than anything we've written before. We've sort of recompressed the storytelling a little bit, which was really fun, actually, but challenging because you get used to the decompressed storytelling and you get used to having a lot more room to do things.
So where do you see how long will story arcs go in Bad Medicine? Is it
the Unseen arc, which is the first arc, is
two
issues.
Okay. Oh, wow. Oh, great.
It's a two-issue arc, then it's followed by a three-issue arc, and then I believe we're doing a standalone.
We're doing three standalones in a row.
Oh.
And then a two-issue arc. And so...
That's smart, guys. I really think that's smart. I mean, honestly, I think in this digital age, it's important to tell your story faster and really give people more story for their... you know, $3 or $4, depending on whatever the cover price is, and obviously first issue free Comic Book Day. So what does the price settle into? $3.50, $3?
Actually, I don't know, but I would guess that's about right.
Okay.
Oni is not one of the priciest publishers on the market, but I think they're in the three range. So, but the first issue is free, so people can determine whether or not they want to continue.
And it's a full issue. I mean, I want to say that because some people
think.
Yeah, some people, you know, do come out with a kind of a sampler on Free Comic Book Day, but much like Six Gun, this is a free full issue. So that's awesome.
You know, this is, and I think that's a really shrewd on their part. If we are the drug dealer, so to speak, giving out the free sample, let the whole issue be the sample. You know, let them know what a whole issue of the book will look like and feel like, and. The great thing is that our first arc was two issues, so even in that case, you only have to buy the second issue to get a sense of what an entire arc feels like.
Definitely, and it looks like I'm looking at an article talking about Bad Medicine. The first issue is Free Comic Book Day in early May. Then issue two is released in June,
mm-hmm.
So that's great. So yeah, you know, I mean, right away. Yeah, you'll know within, you know, two issues if, you know, this is something you want to keep going on, which is certainly the hope. But, yeah, I mean, I think that's great, guys. I when I see people that are just starting out sometimes in Artist Alley, they have their first ideas and their first stories that they want to tell. And this is, you know, going back years, but I still see it today. And it's like, oh, how, you know, what's going on with your book? Oh, well, our first story is going to be 12 issues. It's like, well, good luck. Wow. I mean, that's really something. And you really do. You got to grab that audience and kind of let them know what you're doing and really, you know, serve them in this competitive, and again, I think in that digital market, because I really think when people are trying something new and really coming to comics new and might want to download something, I would feel bad, and I can't place myself in that first time customer's shoes anymore. But it always seems to me that when it's a first issue, and okay, you're going to have to buy five more of them, five more, really. And they're not available right now? You know, I mean, the good thing is, yeah, that second part happens in 30 days, and they resubmit issue one. So this is a great chance to get people for the first hit in May. But if not, they can get the full story in June right away, too.
And that's the hope, is that we're very proud of the first issue of Batmess, and we feel it came out great. Chris did great work. We were very happy with the work we did. So we're hoping that the word of mouth on it, too, will spread so that the people who missed it on Free Comic Book Day can, in fact, do one and two, or pick up one in June and then go walk back to their comic store and pick up two as soon as they realize that they love it. That's the hope, anyway.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, and, you know, hopefully this is certainly early enough that Word Balloon listeners will be ready to pounce on their stores and grab bad medicine, you know, because I think they will do themselves a good service by stepping on this thing with square one. Let's get jump on board. We're all for it.
Yes, please jump on board. No, we've been writing we're closing out sort of the first half. We're sort of viewing this the book in having large movements. So I don't want to call it seasons per se, because I don't want to encourage thinking of this as a television show, because it's a totally different beast. But we are going to build – each arc is going to place another piece of the who this
bigger story
is and what they're dealing with in the world, until everything comes to a head, and then the book will calm down again, and then it'll start building again. And I think in our discussions with James, we've really sort of mapped – as I said, we've got the two-issue story arc, the three-issue story arc, then three standalones, and then two issues. And then at that point, everything will have come to a head, and then it'll reset. And I think there may be like a month off or something, and then
okay,
continue monthly. So those breaks will be used at points to allow the readers to catch their breath and catch up.
So each movement would be a trade? Is that how you see –
Oh,
maybe
if the movements are 10, each movement will probably be two.
Yeah, I would guess.
Okay.
They're going to try and do 5 and 5.
But the whole method of storytelling is going to be – there's not going to be any story, I think, that we've applauded that's going to be more than three, and they're mostly going to be ones and twos.
Okay.
So the trades will be actual collections as opposed to one story arc.
Fantastic.
And then subplots through the story will weave towards these sort of larger things. But we want people to be able to jump in wherever they jump in at the beginning of a new story and feel like, okay, I've got who this team is and what they're after, and this is the demonic possession storyline or whatever it is.
I have to be honest, I mostly buy my own books as hard books and stuff. Where are they digitally? Will this come out digitally starting in June, or will, you know, if you miss the Free Comic Book Day, I mean, certainly, you know, everything shouldn't be expected to be free digitally necessarily, but
I don't know the exact answer on this, if they're going to start off right away, but I know they've talked a lot about digital, and I keep seeing more and more announcements about their other books that are being done digitally, so I think Oni is trying to make that move in that direction.
Okay. All right, well, these are more questions that I can bug Corey or somebody else at the convention. And they're only a couple weeks away, so hopefully we'll have an answer soon. But, no, that's great. And honestly, I really think people that, you know, were smart and jumped on Six Gun, this is another great series to jump on, starting with Free Comic Book Day. So very cool on Bad Medicine. I wanted to ask you guys about – speaking about Agent Luna and just the changes that have been happening with the young female audience in manga, and it seems like that craze has died down, but with Seven Seas and the stuff that you guys do, like, you know, Amazing Agent Luna, it seems like you guys are, you know, still part of that milieu, so you might have a better answer in terms of where is the market now. We've seen a couple publishers, you know, unfortunately cease publication, and I just don't know where the young manga world is currently.
I think, or my sense would be, is that they're online. And I know Seven Seas has made a move to do a lot more web comics to try to capture that audience.
And some of our stuff, the Amazing Agent Jennifer prequel sort of spinoff of Amazing Agent Luna, is going up on Monday, Wednesday, Fridays on Zoom Comics.
Oh, great.
And our new book, Dracula Everlasting, is also up there on Zoom Comics on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And then daily, a page of the original Amazing Agent Luna's is going up so that people can catch up. So I think that – I think Christina's right. I think that market is moving a little bit online. I do think there was a bit of an implosion in the manga craze, kind of collapsed back on itself a little bit. But Seven Seas is still doing licensed manga because that market is still strong.
Okay.
And in terms of original manga, they seem to want to keep Luna going, and we launched Dracula Everlasting last year. So they're still going with new books. I don't know how many new books they're launching with writers that aren't us or Adam Arnold. I think that they're sticking with people that they've worked with whose books seem to connect with their core audience.
Okay. So
they're home to us, but I don't know that they're expanding per se, but they're not going away anytime soon either. So,
well, that's good. Well, and honestly, I'm asking for your guys' benefit as well, because no, honestly, it's great when you do have a publisher that is as receptive as they've been with your stuff. And that's why. So it starts as a web comic, and then when it finishes, is collected. Is that the process?
Well, they've released them as books, and then they're sort of going, because Amazing Agent Jennifer, both volumes are out now. Volume 2 came out in January, but they are putting up. They've been putting up Volume 1 online since last fall, I think, and doing the one page three times a week.
Gotcha.
And I think they're using it as a way to entice viewers. They see it online, they read some pages. Hopefully, they'll go out and buy the book then, because they can't wait and they want to read the whole thing.
And the manga audience is remarkable in that giving them stuff for free has not stopped them from buying things.
Wonderful.
And if that can carry over to the original English language manga, which it seems to at least a little bit, the English language market is much smaller than the licensed manga market.
Understood.
But it doesn't seem – putting it up, I think, has an increased interest in these books. Not de- – like people aren't thinking, well, why should I buy the cow if the milk is free, which is I think what everyone's fear is. And I think that the industry is going to have to realize that that just isn't the case, at least not in the manga experience. So I think that other publishers are going to realize that too, that making content free as an enticement to buy the trades – might be the model of the future, or in the case of the manga and the digest size.
Gotcha. And then, honestly, as independent creators yourselves, you know, is the way that the market in general has changed in comics, is that making you guys change the way you've been doing business in terms of, you know, would you possibly do things like our mutual friend Greg Rucka is doing with Rick Burkett, with Lady Saber and his webcomic that they're doing?
Well,
you know,
that, because that's a fun webcomic and people should be checking it out. It's Lady Saber and the Pirates of the Ineffable Aether.
So you're a better friend of Greg's because you remember the whole title. That's
yeah.
That's very
college roommate and has been my best friend since college. So, but on top of that, he's also the guy who taught us most of what we know about how to write for this particular medium. You know, we both came at screenwriting and television writing ourselves. And when he's turned to that, he's turned to us sometimes and said, okay, I'm jumping forms here. Help me out. But when we jumped into comics, he's the one who was like, here are my scripts. You have any questions, let me know. So he, in addition to being a friend, he's a mentor. So, everything he does, I memorize. But and everything he does, I think people should read, because I think he is a master of the form.
You're preaching to the choir, man. You know that. So.
But yeah, I think we have certainly given some thought, and now with Seven Seas in the business of publishing some of the books that we wrote to be originally published in stores as web comics, and that's the thing. The distinction I do want to make is that our books on Zoom Comics, sometimes you'll get a page that doesn't feel quite like a webcomic page because it was never intended
to
originally.
Stand on its own.
But
understood.
The realization was it could reach the wider audience that way, and so I think that it's brilliant that they do it. But I think, you know, if we wrote a webcomic, we would change the pacing even further, and that compresses it again, you know, even more than we've been compressing on Bad Medicine. And I think that's good for us as writers to experiment with ways to compress our storytelling. I think all of us in the industry could compress our storytelling a little bit.
Sure. Do you guys see ever, like, though, beyond webcomics even, and, you know, that's one path, but, you know, some of these other moves, you know, actually I'm curious as we're recording, it's right before WonderCon. Mark Waite is about to make a big announcement of what he's going to do digitally. And I sense that the webcomic route might not be the way that he's planning, but that's why. I mean, do you see things like what Amazon is doing for creators and Comixology and some of the digital markets and stuff? Do you think you might want to try something original where you might want to self-publish, or you know, I mean, again, is the path that you guys are taking with the publishers serving you the best way right now?
You know, we have a loyal fan base, but it's not the largest loyal fan base. I think Mark, Greg, they can take a chance because their fan base is bigger. I think we are definitely thinking about it and moving, but we have to proceed with a lot more caution because we don't know what kind of hits we could generate on a web comic or how many sales we could generate on a self-publish, how many of our fans will follow us.
Understood.
So we're weighing it because I think it is the way of the future, but I think
sure.
We're perhaps maybe being overcautious sometimes. I think we look at Greg, I have no idea what Mark is going to announce. Mark has circled around doing something. We know Mark, we're friendly with Mark, and he has been fascinated with this for a while, and he's been trying to find the right way. So if he has an announcement, odds are he has looked at this long and hard and has found a smart way, and I, for one, am going to pay very careful attention to what he says. And, you know, I would love for, in my personal opinion, I think that a bunch of us should band together and create an image for the digital age.
Understood. Sure, a group of you guys getting together and starting an imprint and releasing all
truly,
your stuff under an umbrella.
Truly creator-owned, but where the strengths of each elevates the portal, the web portal that would be used, so that people will come for one writer and then jump over to another writer, and so everyone benefits from each other's fan base.
Very interesting. No, I understand. A group of Chicago creators are doing that. Four Star Studios has a digital comic they do called Double Feature, and it's 16 pages a month, and it's 2 8-page stories. And yeah, they're, you know, really leaning on all of their, you know, mutual friends, not only in Chicago but really all across the country. And you're right. I think, you know, it's people like Scotty Young and Mike Norton and Tim Seeley, mm-hmm. and they're all, you know, they've got their indie audiences. But yeah, you pull them together, and they've reached out to people like Gabe Hardman and Karina Bechko, and you know, they get really talented people to write these great little stories.
That's a nice talent pool, and I do think that there's a diverse fan base that they would bring to each other, which would be nice.
There you go. Very cool, man. Awesome, guys. That's great. And seriously, really like Playball, really like Bad Medicine, and you know, continued success with the newly reformatted and newly visualized Avalon Chronicles. So that's great. And all the 7C stuff. Nice going.
Thank you very much.
So, and yeah, you know, let's not wait so long and have a new conversation down the road as Bad Medicine continues to grow.
We would be happy to talk with you about Bad Medicine again, because this one it's going to have so many stories coming out, and therefore it's going to morph from story to story in a wild and sort of wonderful way for us. We're already discovering it, having written five issues into it already. So
very cool. Well, then unchain yourself in 6 months, Christina, and we'll fire it up again with you and Nudes, all right?
Excellent.
Good catching up with Nunzio and Christina. I'm sure we'll be talking with them as Bad Medicine progresses. I'm telling you, this looks like a great series. I'm looking forward to it. I love Play Ball. I think it's a great story as well. Great for young women to get into. And, of course, the Avalon Chronicles, Agent Luna, you name it. These guys really know how to tap into young girl stories. So check out their work, especially check out Bad Medicine. That'll do it for Word Balloon today. John Suntress saying thanks for listening. Of course, Word Balloon today is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. I can't believe some of these deals that are happening right now at InStock Trades. Spawn Origins, the trade paperback, volume 14, $9.29. You can get the ongoing Ghostbusters trade paperback, their first volume. That's just $12.59. Avengers by Bendis, the Heroic Age collection. The hardcover is 38% off, $24.79. Don't forget, again, the Avengers Children's Crusade from Alan Heinberg and Jim Chung. 50% off. It's just $17.49 at InStockTrades.com. And as always, when you have orders of $50 or more, your shipping is free. Check out the deals. They are waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. I hope to see you at Seattle's Emerald City Comic Con, just under 2 weeks away. Really looking forward to seeing everybody there. Of course, we'll see everybody as well at C2E2 and other great announcements coming in the days and weeks ahead. Until next time, thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2012.